From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org, or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, your weekly roundup in news coverage. Now, SDPB has been bringing you the latest on coronavirus in South Dakota. You can find all of our reporting on the website sdpb.org/COVID. On Thursday, SDPB's Seth Tupper sat down with In the Moment host Lori Walsh to talk about the spike in unemployment claims in South Dakota.
Hey, Seth, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with the latest. What are those new unemployment claim numbers looking like?
Yeah, so we've been waiting for these weekly unemployment claim numbers come out every Thursday, and they are eye-popping and astounding. Nationally, for the week ending March 14th, there were 282,000 initial unemployment claim filings. And this, the new numbers ending March 21st, there were 3,283,000 unemployment claim filings. That's about 1,000% increase nationally from one week to the next. And in South Dakota, the numbers went from 190 to 1,703. So that's about an 800% increase just in South Dakota. And those are the new numbers are what they call advance numbers. And so those could change yet. And I did interview an economist this morning from Ball State named Michael Hicks. And I asked him, what are those advance numbers? What does that mean?
So the advance claims are based on the first round of administrative data that comes in. And then what happens is over the next several weeks, those will be revised as people make claims. And the claims are the date that you were unemployed. So some people who lost their jobs this week may not have yet made claims. You know, they may be rushing to get their kids at home or pick up their kid from college like I had to do and you know, go through all that drill. And the consequence of that is that those numbers can be changed for several weeks afterwards as we get new data.
So basically, sort of like the virus itself, you know, we're looking at numbers that are going to increase, and they're going to increase in a pretty big way.
It certainly seems that way. Just to drive home what was said there was that, you know, if you lost your job this week, you may have any number of things you need to deal with this week, next week, the week after. But when you finally file for unemployment, you file on the date you lost your job. So there could have been people that lost their jobs last week who still might not file for two more weeks yet. And so that number will continue to be adjusted as time goes on.
All right, let's put this in a little bit of perspective. What does this look like historically? How does this fit into what happens in South Dakota normally?
Yeah, so this is unprecedented. You can find weekly unemployment claims numbers back to 1987 on the website of the National Department of Labor. If this number holds, about 1,700 claims during the most recent week in South Dakota, this would be the highest ever number filed. The previous high was about 1,300, and that was in 2009 during the Great Recession. And the nationally, the national numbers just obliterated the previous record. The previous record nationally was 695,000 unemployment claims in a week, and the 3 million or so that were recently filed is about five times higher than that previous record, which was set in 1982. So. When I interviewed this economist this morning, wow was his first words upon seeing these numbers this morning. Just unprecedented and astounding, almost unbelievable numbers.
So one of the good things they were saying on Marketplace right now, when you look at those numbers, is that people are accessing the services. They're applying, which is a good thing. And certainly this doesn't reflect the people who haven't figured out how to do that yet. We'll talk about that in a minute. But also, Seth, it's important to note that a lot of businesses aren't closed yet. There haven't been lockdown orders everywhere across the state. So those numbers are still sort of sort of pending. Tell me a little bit about Governor Noem's and the state of South Dakota, her administration's reaction to those unemployment numbers and how they're dealing with them.
Yeah, and it's important to remember just how recent all this is. We didn't have our first presumptive positive case announced in South Dakota until March 10th, which was just a little more than 2 weeks ago. So March 10th, that happened, and that was on a Tuesday. It was the next week on a Monday after all the state basketball tournaments had been canceled, et cetera, that the unemployment calls really started flooding in. And there's a call center in Aberdeen that the state of South Dakota operates for the unemployment benefits. And they had to staff up that call center in a hurry as they had a flood of calls coming in. Governor Noem talked about that a few days ago on a conference call that she had with reporters.
Now, under normal circumstances, the unemployment insurance call center operates with about 11 staff. Since the significant influx of claims, we have added 16 more staff members in this area to help take calls, to reset passwords, and process online claims. We have 92 phone lines that are available today. We are adding an additional 23.
So no long lines. We're not seeing people standing in line 6 feet apart to get benefits. This is a phone.
Well, and there's a reason for that. Unfortunately, because of the coronavirus and the concerns about spreading it, the job service offices that are located across the state where you could normally go in and get help filing a claim right there in the office, those are all closed. So you cannot physically go in and file for unemployment right now. The only way to do it is to either call the number for the call center in Aberdeen or to go online to the website and file that way. So one of the other things they're doing with the staff they're adding in Aberdeen is, people may have filed for unemployment 10 years ago and gotten an account on the website, and now they're trying to file again and they don't remember their password. Mm-hmm. And they're running into a problem with that. So they had to add staff members to reset passwords and work through those problems. So the wait time on the call center was about an hour as of last week, the state said. And, I would love to hear experiences if there are people listening out there, what their experiences have been with that. I can imagine that some people are having trouble, not only technically on the website, but getting through on the call and trying to get those claims filed.
Yeah. And if you do have calls and you want to send us, you can email us at inthemoment@sdpb.org or send a text or call 956-SDPB. That's 605-956-SDPB. All right, Seth, let's talk a little bit about how this works. What exactly is unemployment insurance? Because for many people, the governor pointed out at his press conference, this is brand new to a lot of people.
Yeah, something that you don't think about until you need it. And in South Dakota, we actually call it reemployment assistance. That was actually changed within the last year or two, basically because Republicans in the legislature think that reemployment assistance sounds better than unemployment assistance. So the name change really didn't change anything with the program, but that's what they call it. But the way it works is when you work and you make an hourly wage, your employer is taxed a small percentage on basically the first $15,000 of your wages. They pay that payroll tax into a trust fund that the state manages. And then if you are out of work through no fault of your own, if you're laid off, for example, you can apply to that fund for benefits as you try to find other work to have at least some income coming in to get you by until you're able to find work again.
Do you have a sense of how much? Is it based on what you made before? Is it just a bottom line for everyone?
Yep, it's based on what you make. So basically, you can make up to 48% of your hourly wage, up to a maximum of $414 per week. And the maximum term is 26 weeks. Now, that is changing, and we can talk about that. The stimulus package that is just now passing through Congress this week is going to make some changes for that and make people eligible for a greater benefit. And there are some changes. The state has already loosened up a requirement. If you've lost work because of COVID-19, you don't need to necessarily be searching for other work. Right now, you can still get unemployment benefits. And so they're already making some changes to make more people eligible.
So the reemployment definition changes a little bit here.
Right. It's called reemployment assistance, but during this period where we're all dealing with COVID-19, you don't necessarily have to be looking for other work to get unemployment benefits. And I suppose the reason for that is a lot of people have simply been sent home, you know, on leave or without pay, and they expect that they'll be able to come back, but may not be getting paid right now. And we're being told that those people would be eligible for unemployment benefits.
Tell me a little bit about that congressional stimulus package and what you're hearing from our congressional representatives about it.
Yeah, so I interviewed Representative Dusty Johnson yesterday, and here's what he said about the piece of the stimulus bill that deals with unemployment insurance.
Yeah, I mean, there's a massive investment in unemployment insurance. I mean, you know, more benefits, longer benefits, more people eligible. I mean, it's the most, you know, breathtaking change in unemployment insurance ever.
And so, yeah, we're still trying to figure out what exactly is in the bill. I haven't read all 800 and some pages of the bill, if you can believe that, yet. But from what I have been able to see, the bill expands eligibility. So if people are even self-employed people and part-time workers can be eligible now under the stimulus package for unemployment benefits. And it also looks like there's going to be an extra $600 per week on top of the whatever the maximum benefit is in your state. So, for example, in South Dakota, the maximum would typically be $414 that you could per week that you could top out at. You can add another $600 to that, apparently, and it would be $1,014 that you'd be potentially eligible for up to that amount of unemployment insurance under this new bill.
All right. Everybody wants to know when, how soon will some of these things, if you apply for unemployment insurance, when do you start getting benefits beyond the stimulus package, which could change it again, but just the basic, what we have in the state, how long does it take to enact?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I don't know from the time. I would imagine under normal circumstances, certainly it would only be a matter of days, but I don't know how long it's taking right now. Obviously, they're swamped with calls, and I'm sure that it remains to be seen how they're going to incorporate the stimulus package into the existing benefits. And, you know, if you're going to get that expanded amount already, or if you'll start getting the $414, maybe you can be qualified for the greater amount later. All that remains to be worked out, basically, yet.
How deep are the pockets of that trust fund? When does that run out?
Yeah, and so the current balance of the state's unemployment insurance trust fund is $132 million, and that sounds like a lot of money. But, you know, our unemployment insurance trust fund has needed help before when it almost ran out of money during the Great Recession. The state actually had to borrow $24 million from the federal government and expand eligibility in order as an agreement with the feds in order to keep our trust fund solvent. And so that has since been paid back. And we had returned after the Great Recession to a lot lower levels of unemployment filings. But now we're in a new reality suddenly. And so I called Senator Brock Greenfield. He's a state senator, a Republican from Clark. And I asked him how he's feeling about the trust fund balance.
It's obviously a lot of money, but it can be utilized in the blink of an eye. So I don't know what the draw will be on the unemployment insurance trust fund as time goes by, but we certainly do have a concern, and we want to make sure that our people in South Dakota are taken care of in these troubled times.
Tough for state lawmakers to sort through this. You really even hear that in his voice, I think, can't you?
Yeah, and I would imagine that lawmakers, I don't know if it'll be public or maybe it'll just be private at that point, but when they come back for the veto day here shortly of the legislature, among many other things that will be discussed, I'm sure some of them will be talking about the unemployment trust fund and how long that's going to last and whether any adjustments need to be made to that as we did during the recession.
So Congressman Johnson is optimistic. Tell me a little bit about what's behind that optimism for him.
Well, you know, there are economists who say that the unemployment claims we saw this week, as incredible as they were, are only, you know, the beginning. And we may even see, you know, worse numbers next week and the following weeks. Congressman Johnson seems more optimistic. The new stimulus package includes money that will pay businesses to keep up their payroll for 8 weeks. So, you know, what they intend in Congress is for employers to keep people on their payrolls, to hire back people immediately. And so he tends to think that maybe we won't have as much of an unemployment problem as some economists say. Here's what he said about that.
Yeah, for people whose businesses don't call them back, yeah, I mean, they would be able to access the unemployment insurance system. You know, given that small businesses, I mean, in essence, are going to have all of their payroll expenses paid for by the federal government, I'll be surprised if there's not an aggressive and robust hiring back, you know, in a matter of days.
In a matter of days. So business owners want to know a lot about those forgivable business loans. That's the first time I think I've heard that those words put together. You just reported on that. It was on our news. But explain a little bit for listeners what those forgivable loans are in theory going to do and where people are going to access that money and how soon.
Yeah, I was really curious about this because as we've heard business owners for the last couple of weeks panicking and wondering what they're going to do as their revenue just dried up overnight. A lot of them have said, well, I'm waiting around to see what Congress does and what this money is going to be that's supposed to help me out. So when the deal was struck in Congress yesterday on the stimulus package, that's what I wanted to know is, okay, there's money there for small businesses. How do they get it? And so I called Congressman Johnson and some others and was told that basically you need to call your local bank. And what's going to happen is there's about a $350 billion pot of money that is going to go to the U.S. Small Business Administration. And then they're going to work as quickly as they can. They've been given apparently 15 days to make rules on the use of this money and get that money out immediately to local banks. And then local banks will basically service those loans, sign business owners up, and the money will come from the federal government through these banks. And so the idea is that local businesses would have 8 weeks of money to pay their payroll, to pay their overhead, to pay their mortgage, their rent, their light bill, that kind of thing, to get them through this period so they can keep people on the payroll for the time being. So that when the health crisis ends or recedes, instead of having to hire everybody back, hopefully everybody would still have their jobs, or a lot of people would, and the economy will be ready to take off again.
Do we have an idea of who qualifies for that? What kinds of businesses? Some seem obvious. Others are in a gray area.
It sounds like basically anybody. Again, this is all kind of in flux as the bill is just moving through Congress this week. The Small Business Administration is going to have to iron all that out. But from when I talked to Congressman Johnson yesterday, it sounds like, you know, if you're a business that's been affected by COVID-19 and, you know, what business hasn't at this point, basically, you're going to be able to apply for this. And it sounds like there'll be some kind of tracking to make sure, you know, you spend the money on payroll and on your mortgage, on your rent, on your overhead, et cetera. But as long as you do spend the money on those things, apparently you're going to have the ability to have that loan forgiven over time.
Now, just before Governor Christine Noem's press conference on Thursday, Rob Monson, Executive Director of the School Administrators of South Dakota, joined us for a look at how schools across the state are adjusting to the abrupt shift to online learning.
Rob Monson, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Lori. Thanks for having me.
How are you holding up? How is your health? And this is a trying time for everybody. What do you sort of reach to, I mean, obviously you have a lot of purpose right now. How are you keeping that balance?
Well, it sure is. It's trying times for everyone. And, you know, we all just have to, you know, dig deep and, number one, take care of ourselves and those around us, you know, our loved ones, our families close to us. And then, you know, do our best to provide support to everyone else we can. And from the perch I sit in, we have 149 school districts, public in South Dakota, and a number of privates that are members with our association. And we're just doing the best to provide updated information and reaching out to them and offering any support we can, you know, to answer questions, to find things for them that we can help with. So really that's, you know, kind of my role right now is just being somewhat of a messenger and providing support and telling them to stay well.
Yeah. All schools in the state are closed. Is that correct?
Well, I always hate to correct a reporter, but the school buildings are closed, but school is going on, Lori.
There you go. All right. All school buildings. Kids are not in school, but they're still in school. All right. What does that
correct.
Look like?
And that's a, Well, that's a whole new paradigm. You know, obviously there are districts that were in better positions than others. You know, the one-to-one initiative with computers and things has been in the state for quite some time, but never really tested at this level. And so you have districts that are at different, you know, points in time of where they're delivering this education or have been delivering this education. And the challenging part really becomes, you know, those elementary kiddos. You know, you just can't put a laptop in front of them in kindergarten or first grade and, you know, pump information out to them and expect something great to happen. So there's lots of different approaches to that. There's packets going home. There are some online things to be delivered. South Dakota Public Broadcasting is stepping in and providing some wonderful content. So really, there's lots of things happening. And the cliche I've been using is that a lot of people are building this airplane as they're flying it.
Right. Is every district kind of doing their own thing? Is there guidance from the state or guidance from your organization to say this is how to do it? Here are the standards. Here's you know, here are some best practices. Or is everybody
Yeah, that's the unique thing about you know, a lot of states, but South Dakota in particular, is you know, local control trumps a lot of things. So, you know, everyone is sort of doing their own thing, but there's a lot of communication between districts, between superintendents, through our office, through the Department of Education. You know, instead of everyone reinventing, they're talking to other folks and saying, you know, what platforms are you using? How are you doing this? What's your policy? Or how are you handling the kids coming and going from school to pick things up? Do you have teachers coming into the buildings? You know, all those things. So there's really great dialogue at the administrative level of superintendents talking to one another and the Department of Ed stepping in and providing a couple of conference calls a week just to talk about, you know, what's the key thing we need to be knowing about right now and providing information. So just a lot of good communication.
Tell me a little bit about how some of those districts are really responding. What are some of the, I mean, I've seen teachers driving through neighborhoods and kids going out on their, you know, their front yards to wave at them. I've seen, you know, music teachers doing some really innovative things in tough circumstances. What have you seen from districts across the state that really gives you encouragement for the innovation, the creativity, and the dedication of these educators?
You know, when this, Lori, when this first kind of was thrown upon our laps, you know, we were just coming out of legislative session. So a lot of us had focus on, you know, getting some key legislative bills passed, including funding and some relief to capital outlay. So we get through that on Thursday, and then all of a sudden Friday, we get this notice of, hey, everybody, we're hitting the stop button here for a minute. We're going to take next week off. There were some school districts that were lucky in retrospect that maybe they had a spring break built in for a couple of days there and just had a natural break. So a lot just kind of, you know, sat there and thought, okay, what do we do next? It gave some people some time to plan and get ready for, you know, inevitably what we knew would probably be coming longer closures of our buildings. So there was a lot of designing and building going on then. Some of the more novel things I've seen, Lori, again, in the superintendent group that is talking over and over, one of the school districts had assigned teachers almost like a mail route for their students who were out in the rural community. So these teachers would grab the sack lunches. They would take the homework that needed to go out and any other information. They would drive out in the country, stop at the house, you know, keep their safe distance, obviously, check in on everybody, see how they're doing, deliver the lunches, drop off what they needed, pick up what they needed, you know, and doing that on a daily or every other day basis. So it's things like that, setting up Zoom meetings with students, setting up any kind of communication to, you know, be talking to the students, checking in on them, providing access to information and answering questions. Just a lot of innovative things that are happening out there.
For parents who are frustrated that we didn't just, schools didn't just go to an early summer break and then come back later, who are saying, how am I supposed to supervise a packet and work from home, or I just lost my job, or some parents who are feeling like the burden of education is now, you know, on their kitchen table in a way that it wasn't before, what's your message to them about keeping school in session?
Yeah, one of the messages that I and a number of people are trying to send out, Lori, is number one, take care of the mental health of our children first and their safety and all of those things they need first. That's key, kind of the Maslow's, you know, make sure we take care of the basic needs. And the message I've been trying to send is remember, you're sending things home to parents who are not the professional teacher that you are. So expecting them to carry out sort of the jobs that we do every day in our schools is a high expectation. Try not to overwhelm them. Just be rest assured, we're trying to provide some supplemental and some additional growth type things. So let's just try and do that and make sure we aren't overwhelming them. So that's really the message we're trying to say. And we know parents are busy at home. They're stressed out. You know, some are probably getting laid off or sent home. So trying to complete homework packets and all that may not be their top priority. Right. So just do the best we can. Make sure we're taking care of those people and just don't overwhelm them at home.
And that goes for teachers and administrators and school employees as well. They have, if they have children and they're working and driving those rural routes and coming up with new lesson plans while they take care of their own children. There is a great, much is being asked of all of us now, really, in a lot of ways. That's not, we're all acknowledging that, I think, at this point.
And some of the more interesting things happening are in some of the communities, the schools are being asked, and schools have always been a hub of the community, you know, where activities happening, whether it's the play or the basketball or football games, it is the central hub of entertainment activity in a school. And the communities are turning to schools now and saying, we need help with some childcare. We need you to be watching some of these school age students while the healthcare workers or the 3M workers who are making masks, you know, can go do the critical jobs right now. So schools have been stepping up doing even that kind of work.
Interesting. I want to talk a little bit, and just so listeners know, in about a minute or two, we expect Governor Kristi Noem to take the podium in the Capitol building and in Pierre, and we'll interrupt Rob at that point, and we'll go to that press conference so you can hear it live. But in the remaining 30 seconds I expect we'll have here, Rob, can you tell us a little bit about equity and just how we're dealing with some of these disparities between, you know, kids with IEPs or kids without internet? That's a tough situation to work through on a student-by-student basis, isn't it?
Yeah, and I sure can't do that justice in 30 seconds, but I'll tell you this. Students who are on IEPs are a whole different world than your average student that's coming into the school by contract and law and all sorts of pieces that we're all trying to meet those letter of the law and meet the meeting deadlines and providing the services. We're doing the best we can in the schools. And as far as equity, you are correct. You know, many homes have internet connectivity and are able to pick this up running. Others are struggling with that. We're proud of a number of internet providers that are stepping in and providing that for free, or at least trying to. So, there are disparities there of what's going to get turned back into the schools and what's going to get done. So, again, it's just, you know, let's keep an eye on everybody and just try to all get through this together. And most importantly, when we look back, remember that we all made it through this together and we're moving on.
And all of these measures are for good reason. The number of COVID-19 cases in South Dakota will increase in coming months. And as a result, Governor Kristi Noem released an executive order this week recommending business and community responses to the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the order is not a legal mandate, even though state law gives the governor such authority during an emergency. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Governor Kristi Noem issued an executive order establishing that every South Dakota business and government agency should adhere to important public health guidelines.
I want to make sure that we're all on the same page, and it is my job as governor in an emergency situation to set a baseline for what our communities can do. If community leaders want to go above and beyond that, that is what a decision that they can make together.
The governor stopped short of calling it a mandate, which leaves local government to make their own decisions. At least two cities, Rapid City and Huron, have already passed ordinances that shut down certain business. Two others, Sioux Falls and Deadwood, are considering separate measures. Noem's executive order came one day after Beadle County reported its positive cases went from 6 to 10. At that time, Noem declined to call it community spread. Since then, Beadle County has reported even more positive cases, including one state lawmaker. Governor Noem's administration now says there is community spread in three separate counties. Officials in Huron and Beadle County moved quickly and became the first in the state to close their bars and restaurants. Food pickup is still allowed.
even though we had done it before she put out the guideline, that was basically what we followed.
That's Paul Aylward, the mayor of Huron. Aylward says he's glad the governor put out the executive order to back up the actions of the county and the city.
I thought it would have more force if it came from the governor and included the entire state. But she has different views on that. So we went ahead and we thought that it was necessary to protect the citizens of Huron and do everything that we could do.
It's an inconsistent approach that concerns Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Tenhaken. He says the Sioux Falls Council could approve action to shut down restaurants, bars, and other businesses. However,
that action applies to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and not to T, and not to Harrisburg, not to Lenox, not to Canton, not to Hartford, not to Humboldt, not to Brandon. And they would all have to create their own ordinances to comply. And you can see where this gets very challenging to enforce this. The virus does not respect city limits.
Tenhaken says if Sioux Falls acts, other nearby municipalities will need to make their own decisions about what to do. Tenhaken would prefer a statewide mandate of some kind. He says that would present a consistent response across the state to address the pandemic. Noem says she doesn't have that authority. Instead, her administration is recommending what municipalities and businesses should be doing.
This executive order is detailed. It gives specific guidelines and recommendations on what we should be going on in the state of South Dakota. I'll continue to tell the state what I think they should be doing and what everybody should be doing, and we'll give that type of guidance. It also specifically says to follow CDC guidance, as that is the best information that we have on how we can control this virus and protect as many people as possible.
State law gives the governor the authority to place restrictions on people and businesses during an emergency. Leaders in Rapid City also acted before the governor issued her executive order. Rapid City officials approved the first reading of an ordinance that could order many non-essential businesses to shut down. Mayor Steve Allender says he's pleased with the local response.
It doesn't change our course. We're on the right path. It may embolden other communities to take action.
Dozens attended a Sunday night city council meeting in what's becoming a fierce debate between economic and public health responses. Rapid City will have a second and final vote on Friday to shutter non-essential businesses. Grocery and gas stations will remain open. Restaurants and bars can offer curbside pickup. Deadwood City Council is considering a similar restriction, along with an ordinance that would require casinos to close. Nathan Sanderson is the executive director of the South Dakota Retailers Association. He says retailers haven't responded to him about the governor's executive order because they're already working with public health guidelines. Sanderson says businesses are hungry for some guidance because they're navigating conflicting battles.
It's not whether they themselves are going to go under or not, although that's certainly a possibility. They're not thinking of themselves first. They're thinking of their employees first. And so when they're forced to close, it's not just their own lives that are impacted, it's all their employees. And I think that a little bit of guidance helping them navigate that space is very welcome.
State officials say models predicting the number of COVID-19 cases in South Dakota may peak in May. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strupinger in Rapid City.
Through all of this, we've been trying to keep up with hospitals around the state. Sanford is certainly one of the bigger ones, so we had Dr. Dan Heineman, he is Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at Sanford Health, join us to let us know the advancements and preparations they're making.
Dr. Heineman, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Ah, thanks, Lori. Thanks for having us.
We have many questions from listeners who have been sending in their thoughts for us, but I wanted to ask you first, in your mind, what's the most pressing question for today? What do you think is, this is such a rapidly changing story. What's the snapshot right now for you?
Well, I think we're still at a point where if we behave properly, and by behaving properly, I talk about social isolation and distancing, continuing to wash our hands, watch where we go, and only go when absolutely have to, we still have an opportunity to change the kind of the trajectory or the severity of this outbreak for our area. Again, it's a plea. If you can stay home, stay home. If you have to go out, make it absolutely important that you go out and make sure you wash your hands before you go into a location, and then make sure you wash your hands when you come out of a location, and then just kind of continue to stay at home.
It is still possible to make a difference. These behaviors are making a difference, is what I'm hearing you say.
It is still possible. And a lot of this is we're now at a spot where we need to make sure that we can protect our healthcare workforce. And so that's another reason why these kinds of things are very important, to protect the people that have to come to work and take care of the patients. And if we start to lose our workforce, it puts the care in jeopardy.
Dr. Anthony Fauci said during President Donald Trump's and the task force, the White House task force press conference last night, that he was very important to shine a light on these communities where there hasn't been a lot of testing right now. Reporters asked him to be more specific about that. Like, where are you talking about? President Trump said, the Farm Belt, for example. Tell me a little bit about testing data. Are we really, it's so important to get those tests done? Are we seeing a change in how we're doing those tests? And are we getting more data now that we really need?
Well, we are in a spot where we can get more testing. It can still be a little frustrating, as we have tests that are out there that are still pending. But our local healthcare organizations have now begun testing locally. In other words, both Sanford and Avera are now able to do a test in-house. We can't do thousands and thousands of tests a day, but we're ramping up to do probably 400 to 800 a day over the next few days. And that will help us to understand who's positive. Now, we may be using a lot of that testing for our inpatients. Give me an example. We could have 14 patients in our hospital who screened out and have symptoms, and we've tested, and now we've put them in an isolation area. We've got all kinds of protective equipment on our staff that are taking care of them. Getting that information back in 24 hours versus 5 to 6 days can tell us whether we need to keep the patient in isolation, whether we can move that patient to another part of the hospital and not have to use as much of our valuable protective equipment to continue to care for that patient. Mm-hmm. So that's one way where testing is going to be very helpful. As testing becomes even more prevalent, we can now start to see once what the prevalence of community spread or kind of spread of the virus is in a community, and that can help us kind of understand what we need to do. But until we get that kind of testing ability, it is crucial to kind of limit our exposures to others so we don't pass this disease on.
Right.
It must be spread person to person. And if we interrupt that chain, we will slow that progression down and allow our healthcare systems to be able to manage the patients that need to be managed.
All right, I have a couple sort of rapid fire, I hope, questions for you. I'm going to ask you to answer these in as quickly
Sure.
as you can so we can get through some of these listener requests. Some people are sending out social media requests to sew masks, sew equipment for healthcare workers. Is that something you could even accept?
Not right now. We don't believe that there's a fabric out there that we could accept for healthcare workers at this time. We've got what we believe right now to be adequate supplies of protective equipment. If our communities continue to help us keep the spread down and at a manageable rate, we should be able to manage with the protective equipment we have today. Now, we are constantly reevaluating the amount of protective equipment we have. So we're not accepting homemade masks at this time because we can't test them to prove that they're going to protect our healthcare workers when they are exposed to the virus.
The tests that we are doing
now,
do they stay good for a period of time before processing? When we're hearing about a backlog, are the samples still good? Okay.
The samples are good because we're looking to detect virus in the samples. It's in viral transport media. So, yes, they are. It's not like they degrade over time, and they're in a controlled environment once they get to the lab, and then they're in a queue. So the labs are doing everything they're everything they can possibly do to maintain the integrity, if you will, of that sample.
Is every hospital system making their own guidelines for ethical choices, in triage? New York State has released a statewide guidelines. Is that coming from the state of South Dakota, or does Sanford and Avera and Monument make their own internal guidelines for how triage decisions are made?
Most of those guidelines may be made by internally by an organization, but they're guided by a acceptable ethical standards that are out there. So while the actual language of each individual policy might be a little bit different, it's guided by overall ethical principles that are out there, as well as what would be considered standard medical care. So even though the Sanford policy might look a little different than the Avera policy or the Monument policy or the Prairie Lakes policy or you name its policy, they are all guided and drafted under the guidance of routine standard ethical policies.
Yeah. What kind of transparency are we committed to in the future? And here's what's behind this question. In other cities, what's happening is healthcare workers are going home and they're saying, this is a terrible day. I put 31 people on vents in one shift, but nobody can talk to the media about it. Rumors are circulating. And so some hospitals have started putting a daily count. How many COVID-19 positive cases do they have? How many ICU beds are being used? And in the effort to squash those rumors. Going forward, as things get a little worse, what kind of transparency is Sanford sort of looking at to keep those rumors, to keep the facts in the community?
We need to be careful that individuals' rights are still protected. And I think what I would suggest, and this is happening, is that our State Department of Health is a great clearinghouse for all of this data. So Sanford, Avera, Monument, lots of folks are reporting that data to our Department of Health and to local incident commanders, if you will. So I believe that the public should expect that they're going to get accurate information from their local as well as their statewide public health authorities in terms of what's going on. I think there's been good transparency at a statewide level. You might not know the names of individuals, but it's very clear, and our state has been very clear in documenting and indicating where the tests are, because that's important to help communities understand whether they need to bear down a little bit more on their communities' adherence to social distancing and other good public health policies.
So what's behind that, I'm sure you understand, is this this fear of people that their local hospital is going to not be able to keep up with the surge. So that's why people are asking for hospitals to say how many, and some of it's a comfort measure. I get it. They want to just know something, and nobody's asking to violate anyone's privacy or tell us who is there. But if somebody has the question, is Avera in Sioux Falls? Is that hospital full? Or, how many beds are they increasing? Those are the kinds of questions people are trying to get at with that transparency question.
Well, I think there is transparency in that all of that information. We have the chief medical officer for Sanford Health, Sanford Medical Center, sits on the Minnehaha County Sioux Falls Incident Command, and he's there specifically to kind of update that incident command on where Sanford is at. So they're sharing that information. So that would be the place where that information should come from. And I think our community is in a really good spot because we have excellent cooperation between the two health systems, the county, the city. We're all in this together, and we work very well together. So I would suggest to your listeners that we are being transparent. We are sharing that data, and that information is out there for people. It may not be coming from Sanford and Avera and or Monument, but it is out there and it is being shared.
Through the Department of Health.
Through the Department of Health.
Yeah. It's just important to remind people, not through your local Facebook feed, through the South Dakota Department of Health at covid.sd.gov. And we, of course, provide those reports on SDPB radio as well. As Sanford facilities are evaluating surge capacity, we're also watching what's happening in the nation, especially in places like New York. How do you feel about our ability? And there are many modeling things online with, you know, how many, based on your population, Governor Kristi Noem said 30% of our population could fall ill with this. 80% it will be mild, but that leaves 20% that could be serious. That's 52,000 people who could have serious illness in South Dakota. How do you, in our remaining 2 minutes, look at surge capacity for individual communities and prepare to be as responsive as you might need to be?
If all of that number came down with COVID-19 and were severe at the same time, we will overwhelm the system that we have in the state of South Dakota. Our goal has always been, since we started this preparation in January, to do everything we can to mitigate that number showing up in a few days. If we see that number over a period of days, weeks, probably weeks more than days, but weeks, we can manage that in South Dakota. And if people cooperate and we help mitigate the spread, then we will have fewer numbers of people at any one time that need to be hospitalized. And that's what has to happen. And that's why that's part of our preparation and our planning, is what can we do to mitigate this so we can manage the influx of patients that need the care. Mm-hmm. Testing helps us with that, because now we have a patient that's been admitted to one of our reverse airflow rooms. Mm-hmm. We get the testing back in 24 hours, negative. Now we can transfer that patient to another part of the hospital. Yeah. Now allows a bed, a protected bed, and possibly even a ventilator if necessary, to be available for that individual.
Dan Heineman,
it all comes down to managing that number.
It all comes down to us doing what we've been asked to do and doing it really well and doing it right now. Dan Heineman, thank you so much for being here with us. Dr. Heineman, we appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for, again, asking us, and we're available anytime.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you're looking for an individual segment, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following that In the Moment Segments podcast. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwempke, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.